Hello to all my fellow 101 History Podcast listeners out there. I know it has been some time since I was on the air last, and I will admit that it was probably at least almost three weeks ago that I was on the air last. And I know that that is a first. I know normally I take probably about a week at most after completing one series and then moving on to the next. For starters, everything is fine, but I've had a lot of other things going on, and as I've said before, and I could say here again, that podcasting, as much as I enjoy it, I also know that I cannot make that my life. Even though it's a side hobby, I also know that there are many other things out there that have to take precedent over being on the air. The good news is that during this time that I was off the air, I was able to decide on where to go next, which is always a good thing. On the other hand, I wasn't sure if I wanted to continue on forward. In other words, I said to myself, you know, I've done 34 books. How many more out there are there possible to do in terms of story-wise and topic? When I started the podcast book topic series that we will be doing here, when I first began the prologue, folks, I will have to confess to you that on the first page, I didn't even get through the first page, but I only got through it halfway. And then I realized to myself I did not even like my prologue. That's okay. I'm not a professional writer, but I am doing the best I can, and I know that for a fact that I have done everything there is to give you all as many good stories as there are out there based upon what I've done since June of 2020. I'm not trying to flaunt, but hey, after 59,000 some plays, I can't say that we're still moving along in the right direction. So I took some time, and then I said to myself, well, Kirk, you can do this story. You're just going to have to refine what you started from the original prologue, even though it was half a page. And so I refined it, and I have a prologue. At the end of the day, when it's all said and done with, I came up with a five-page prologue. So to me, that's better than nothing. And we will be getting into the actual introduction of our book topic podcast series here shortly. I know normally when I'm not on the air for probably about a week or so, sometimes I've said in times past I've been on assignment and all. Now this weekend, my wife and I were kind of on an assignment. Yesterday, for that matter, we went up to Fredericksburg. Just about an hour and 15 minutes north of where we live. And we hadn't been back to this estate in 17 years, historic estate, that is. Some of you in Virginia would know about it. I don't know if the rest of you would know. On one hand, that's okay, because I'm going to tell you all where my wife and I went yesterday. We went to a place in Fredericksburg called Fairy Farm. And it has to do with where George Washington and his family moved to when he was about the age of six in 1738. And the reason why it's called Fairy Farm, folks, because for one, his father invested in money that he had. He invested in building an estate along the Rappahannock River. But Fairy Farm got its name as a result of the ferry service that came in and around the Rappahannock River to and from the actual Fairy Farm estate and transporting people who came to visit the Washingtons. And also, too, when looking at the Rappahannock River from behind Washington's estate, you know, today's time, you've got houses all around overlooking the Rappahannock River, which is nice, but in Washington's time, I don't think you would have seen house placed nearby house. There would have been wharves. In other words, wharves where where facilities would have been located for storing goods, where that would have been loaded onto ships, and goods coming off of ships placed into these facilities for future purposes. So there would have been a lot of ships coming in and coming both in and out of the Rappahannock River, and I'm not talking the modern day cargo vessels that you might see out in the heart of the Atlantic and Pacific Ocean. We're talking about, you know, schooners, other clipper sized ships that it may be a ship like what we could think of as, say, like, you know, the Susan Constant and the Godspeed, that kind of thing, but that came to Jamestown, but ships that came in and out of the Rappahannock River to transport goods and so forth. But nonetheless, long story short, my wife and I were at Ferry Farm 17 years ago, the first go around, and they were in the works of trying to locate where the original house stood. In other words, the original main house. 2 years after 2006, archaeologists actually uncovered the original structural dwelling of where the house stood. And in 2018, they did build a replica of what the house would have looked like in its time. And my wife and I got to go inside and get a tour, and it was very well worth the time. We also learned that, believe it or not, folks, over 700,000 artifacts have been found at Ferry Farm. And this is not during so much during the time that George Washington was living, but before he came into the world, when Indians were living along the, when Indians occupied the area of the Rappahannock in present-day Fredericksburg. Also, artifacts have been discovered during the time of the Civil War, most notably during the famous Battle of Fredericksburg. We did learn that even federal troops were forced to take apart the Ferry Farm estate to turn the wood into fuel to keep them warm during the cold winter months. As one federal soldier said, I feel terrible taking apart George Washington's home, knowing that he lived here. Well, of course, this soldier probably didn't know that Washington had more than one home that he had lived in throughout his life. So, for those of you who are looking for a great getaway trip to Fredericksburg, there's more to do than just Ferry Farm there, but it is very well worth the time. I would definitely go back there again to visit some other point down the road. You know, another thing I have to be constantly reminded of is, you know, the world is changing day in and day out. And I know that, you know, some people could say, well, this change might not be necessarily bad. Perhaps not. But one thing I did learn, and I think we all need to be reminded of this, is that sometimes our bodies were never meant to be equipped to handle rapid changes daily. In other words, from, I guess what I'm saying here is, like, from a technological standpoint, you know, tomorrow they could come out with the newest phone. Well, what do you know? 6 months later, they'll come out with something different to replace it. You know, in other words, we can't really enjoy whatever has been introduced to us for about 5 years. We'll be lucky if we can enjoy it for a year at best, 6 months to a year. But we have to wonder how much more fast-paced movement are we willing to take. I'm not trying to sound rebellious, folks, but it is just something to think about, knowing how quickly the world changes and all. My dad told me when he was growing up that usually major changes took place, you know, once every 10 years in the workplace. And when it happened, it was a big deal. But you had enough time to not only accept that change, but to adjust to that change and make the most of the new settings without having to worry about what was going to be come in its place a year from now. Things like that just didn't happen, probably back in my parents' time. But of course, even I remember growing up, when I still remind myself that it is hard to believe that there was a time when there was no such thing as Amazon. We had to go through a catalog. We survived. And as others would say, and it is true, we turned out fine. But anyways, I think it's probably fair to say that we better get a move on where we're going next in this next book topic podcast series. I will tell you this, that we are actually going to be in the American Revolution. We're going to go back to the American Revolution, one of my favorite periods of history. And I know some of you are probably thinking, you know, Kirk, what else is there to cover about with the American Revolution? Well, I mean, yes, we have taken a break from it. I mean, there's nothing wrong with taking a break from a subject that I do enjoy talking about. But I did find something that I know is worth talking about. Some of you might know about this particular topic, others may not. But for those of you who don't, my job now is to be able to teach you all about, we're going to learn about a person. How about that? Most of us don't know about this person, but that's why I'm here, to help you all out, so that going forward, we're going to understand why this person played a significant role in the Revolutionary War, most notably during its early onset, and the legacy he left behind. So here we go. When studying about America's movement for political independence from a militaristic perspective, we often associate with figures well known to us like General George Washington, given that he was the commander of the Continental Army, which would come as an automatic. Other figures that came to my mind were, say, General Nathaniel Greene, Colonel Francis Marion, a.k.a. the Swamp Fox, Major General Marquis de Lafayette, to Colonel Henry Knox, just some of the many officers whom led troops into battles over an eight-year period from 1775 to 1783. While it's important to learn about how Continental Army officers coordinated their tactical strategies leading up to actual combat against British forces, we often forget what went on behind the scenes prior to both armies squaring off up close. Well, I think it's fair to say that, yes, we've always, you know, we always get told about how they squared off in battle, you know, taking turns firing at one another, you know, who knocked down more men over the other, when did the other side finally get worn out to the point where their retreat, say, was not coordinated properly and then got routed. Yeah, all that's, you know, important to know, but the more important thing that we often forget, though, is what is going on behind the scenes prior to a battle taking place, or prior to you know, even skirmishing taking place, because oftentimes we think it's just the big battle itself, but sometimes we do have to be reminded that even skirmishes take place before an actual major battle itself begins. Hang tight for just a moment. Real quick, I will tell you all this too. I had been somewhat under the weather recently, but I am a lot better lately, and I'm just thankful that it was not any worse. But the good news is that I've been doing everything there is to take care of myself, and drinking lots of tea and drinking, you know, the necessary fluids and all that. I know it might seem like a lot to be saying, but the good news is that I'm a lot better, and the good news is that I'm able to be on the air and podcast with you guys. That's the most important thing. Going behind the scenes during the time of the Revolutionary War in America can be considered vague if not properly described or interpreted. Well, yes, going behind the scenes, yeah, if you don't describe it properly, then yes, it's definitely then considered vague. If somebody asks me directly how to best interpret what it means to go behind the scenes during colonial America's eight-year war for political independence against England, I would focus on factors from logistical supplies. What do you mean by logistical supplies? How about, say, like housing the troops? Or how about the distribution of clothing, such as, like, not just clothing, but then how about the distribution of shoes, weaponry from cannon, gunpowder, muskets, rifles, cartridges? Another factor I can think of, such as like scouting. Well, scouting in the sense like sending out light infantry to pinpoint where the enemy was encamped, to engaging the enemy in a series of minor fights. These minor fights being the skirmishes where the opponent over the course of time got worn down, not only leading up to when a big battle might take place, but getting worn down in terms of moving from point A to point B and not knowing how to go about storing their supplies. And this was a great example of how the Southern Continental Army ultimately had to reinvent the game of fighting, especially after the debacle at Camden from August of 1780, how instead of relying on conventional warfare tactics, the goal was to fight irregularly. And by fighting irregularly, Cornwallis's army was eventually worn down in the Carolinas to the point when Cornwallis's forces did engage General Greene's forces at Guilford Courthouse. Despite the British winning, it, as Parliament said, it came at a Pyrrhic cost, it was a Pyrrhic victory that came at a very terrible cost. Cornwallis lost like nearly 400 men. Greene did not even lose anywhere close to that number, folks. His forces might have lost, but their retreat was far more better than that of Cornwallis's. Greene's forces were still able to come away better preserved. And how about this one? Intelligence. Disguising yourself by going undercover behind enemy lines to obtaining information about opposition movement within a specific region to frequenting city, town, or village where population is more loyalist versus patriot, with intentions to infiltrate the system from within. So yes, these are some of the things that often come to my mind when it comes to going behind the scenes during the time in which the Revolutionary War in America was fought. Of course, everyone's entitled to their own opinion, which is fine. But if you asked me, based upon what I just described to you all, those are the factors that will normally come to my mind. For most of us, the year 1775 is best interpreted as one where first shots were fired upon against England at Lexington and Concord, Massachusetts, April 19th. While the importance behind what took place at Lexington and Concord must not be forgotten, we must be reminded of where things stood come 2 months later in June 1775. June 14th, 1775, the Continental Congress established the Continental Army, along with Delegate John Adams of Massachusetts nominating George Washington as the Continental Army Commander-in-Chief. And remember, folks, John Adams firmly believed that a Virginian must be in charge of the Continental Army, and he knew that nobody else was better fit for that duty than George Washington. Washington at first, folks, was very reluctant to take this job, but there were those in Congress who said we're not sure who else could do this job. They may have known a few other people, but the longer the process dragged out, the harder, the more difficult I believe it would have become to have gotten unanimous support. Not just support, but eventual unanimous widespread confirmation. Think of, it's one thing, for Adams to have nominated Washington, but the Congress is going to have to vote on this. And if they can reach a majority, then the nomination not only goes through, but Washington's post is accepted by Congress. Think of it as like a modern-day United States Supreme Court proceeding in the Senate chamber. Forward 5 days later, come June 19th, which saw Washington be commissioned to getting appointed by Congress as the official Continental Army Commander-in-Chief, whose first assignment involved going north to Massachusetts, where he would partake with the Siege of Boston, which began 2 months earlier on April 19th and didn't end until March 17th, 1776, 10 months, 3 weeks, and 6 days. You know, I have to often be reminded that the Siege of Boston, when we think of what's going on in April, around April 19th and then June 17th, yes, there were battles taking place. And it's so easy to think that, well, when Washington arrived to Massachusetts, that's when the siege began. No, the Siege of Boston, folks, was taking place before Washington arrived. And even when Washington arrived to Massachusetts, I mean, he had been made aware that a battle had taken place before he left. But he didn't realize just how tense the battle itself was, being that of Bunker Hill. So, yes, Washington will, his first assignment will be to go north to Massachusetts, where he's going to partake in the Siege of Boston, which had begun 2 months earlier on April 19th and did not end until March 17th, 1776. Of course, whenever we think of the date March 17th, what do we think of? Yeah, we think of St. Patrick's Day, but another thing we can remember, especially for those of us living in the United States, March 17th, 1776, the end of the Siege of Boston. Too often from years past, thanks in part to old school textbooks, we got told that Washington's arrival into Massachusetts around July 2nd, 1775 was peaceful. I wish I could tell you that it was true, folks, but it's not. However, Washington himself, upon inspection of the army, knew what he saw firsthand was not a top-notch unit, but rather militiamen whom were undisciplined. They were not I shouldn't sound judgmental, but it's true, folks. They weren't the most attractive looking men. They didn't have very good hygiene. They just as Washington would come to learn about militiamen, of course this would come over time, that militiamen came and went as they pleased. And Washington knows that, okay, look, if we want to defeat the mightiest empire in the world, nothing's going to be handed to us. We can talk about independence all we want. People can talk about freedom. They could talk about how they're being oppressed. They could talk about how they have been taxed without their consent left and right. They can do all of this they want. But until we get a true, disciplined army that knows how to function, then we can actually show not only our own people what we're made up of, but we might be able to show the world's mightiest power that they have someone to really reckon with. Because I think it'd be fair to say that in Britain, 3,000 miles across the ocean, that Parliament and the King, and of course, there are British troops still in colonial America, but I think it is fair to say that even after Lexington and Concord, and after the aftermath at Bunker Hill, the British realized that what they were fighting was they weren't a bunch of scaredy cat soldiers, that they actually knew how to fight, and for real, folks, they did. At Bunker Hill, the British lost a quarter of their soldiers. Wounded or killed, they lost over 1,100. I mean, they personally played with fire, if you asked me. They never should have, after the second failed frontal assault, they probably should have just surrendered. They probably would have lost, I don't know what their overall numbers would have been in terms of casualties, but it probably would not have ended up being somewhere around 1,100 in terms of casualties for those dead or wounded. But that would have to be for another debate. But what I do know is that even by the time Washington arrives, he knows that this army is still not a top-notch Army, yes, they may have performed well at Bunker Hill and doing what was necessary, but this is going to be a long fight. This isn't going to be anything that's going to just be handed to us overnight. So not long after arriving did Washington and officers under him go about imposing new reforms, from drilling the soldiers, imposing stiff discipline, to establishing an intelligence network given the enemy was nearby and vulnerabilities lied all around. If you ask me what one particular vulnerability, how about people turning on you? You know, just when you have somebody on your side, you never know what tomorrow might bring. You never know if they might get enticed by the British in the form of money to say, hey, look, you know, can you tell us about what's going on over there? Can you tell us about so-and-so? If so, we'll pay you this nice, handsome money to help you and your family. And we all that we ask that you do is just keep hush about it. Hey, I mean, it happens. And most people wouldn't know this, but even Samuel Adams himself was bribed by the British. They tried to bribe him to not make such a big scene, given how adamant he was in opposition towards everything Britain. But Samuel Adams didn't budge. He didn't fall for it. Yes, it's fair to say with no doubts that Massachusetts became the epicenter for sparking flames of rebellion against mother country England before and leading up to April 19th, 1775, when first shots got fired. In today's present time, Massachusetts is surrounded by six states, but during the 18th century, she spent a good deal of time sharing her borders with four states, being New Hampshire to the north, New York to the west, Rhode Island to the southeast, and Connecticut to the southwest. Prior to April 1775, well, before I say that, I'm sure some of you are wondering, well, what about Maine? Well, I think it's fair to say that most of us would know by now that Maine in 1775 was part of Massachusetts. That's right, folks. Maine did not become its own state until 1820. So we have to be reminded that Massachusetts' population was not only just confined to just Massachusetts, but it was tied in with Maine, what we now know as Maine. So that gave Massachusetts a fairly big-sized population, kind of like how with Virginia and what we know as present-day West Virginia being part of Virginia, just to throw an example there. And then what we know as Vermont, folks. Vermont, New York, and New Hampshire for years fought over whom had control over what we know as Vermont. And of course, Vermont wouldn't become a state until 1791. But if that goes to show you right there why the boundary lines were so intense, well, there you have it. So prior to April 1775, when shots broke out, a young 17-year-old man was attending college in Connecticut at a place known today by many as Yale University. But from 1718 to 1887, it got known as Yale College. It's almost 170 years, folks. And I didn't know that myself. I do know that Yale was founded in 1701. Yale is to this day the third oldest collegiate institution of higher learning in the United States, behind Harvard, which was founded in 1636, and William and Mary, 1693, William and Mary being in Williamsburg, not far from where I live. Matter of fact, hard to believe it was 30 years ago in 1993, I remember when William and Mary celebrated its tricentennial, its 300th anniversary. As a matter of fact, if I'm not mistaken, I do remember being in Williamsburg, and I do believe that there were some festivities going on. I don't know I know that Queen Elizabeth, I don't believe she was there. But that's not to say that she could have sent some other members of her family to Williamsburg. Perhaps maybe Charles went in her place. But But I do remember 1993 when William and Mary had celebrated its 300th anniversary. And it's probably fair to say that it is hard to believe 22 years ago, in 2001, that Yale University did celebrate its tricentennial. And hard to believe, in fall of 2001, I was a senior in college. Of course, you know, I didn't know it back then, but knowing what I know now, I just think that's pretty amazing. And to think 13 years from now, in the year 2036, Harvard will celebrate its quadricentennial. So it's amazing to think that Virginia and Massachusetts, being the two leading states that probably set some incredible precedents for sparking, you know, the event, for sparking the flames of independence, Massachusetts being the first, and then Virginia coming along. But Virginia and Massachusetts having some of the oldest universities in America, to me, that's very remarkable unto itself. During the time in which this young fella attended Yale, one could look from the east by partially closing their eyes just to catch a brief view of Long Island Sound, which to this day still lies between Connecticut to the north and Long Island and New York to the south, while just over the distance, not far away, stood the Atlantic Ocean. Yale College, as I mentioned earlier, founded in 1701, was created by our founders on the grounds or beliefs centered around community, education, economics, and religion. Well, we also have to remember, too, folks, that that in the early days of higher academic learning, of course, it was reserved for men, or I should say for boys only. You know, girls learned learned stuff, but not in the same way as the boys did. Boys went on to get, if their families were well enough, they could send them to institutions of higher learning, most notably like, say, a Harvard or a William and Mary or Yale. But we do have to remember that even in our forefathers' time, there were only about nine colleges leading up to the time when America, or the 13 colonies, severed their ties with England. Matter of fact, eight of them were in the north, and only one was in the south, and that being the College of William and Mary. But the irony to it is that one of the big areas of study was that of divinity. So it was expected that not only you study your religion, but that if you were serious enough about it, that you went into the divinity field and became a minister. And a matter of fact, many ministers of these nine colleges were also professors, and in some instances, presidents. Take the College of New Jersey, for example, George Witherspoon, who was the only clergyman whom signed the Declaration of Independence. He taught a fella who would go on to become the father of America's United States Constitution, being that in Mr. James Madison. So George Witherspoon taught James Madison. Yes, folks, James Madison, being from Virginia, ended up going to the College of New Jersey, being what we know is today Princeton. Come the summer of 1772, just 2 years after the infamous Boston Massacre, the 17-year-old student, including a classmate, embarked on a journey where they left campus grounds, with targeted destination being none other than New Haven Harbor. The 17-year-old, by 1772, had been at Yale for 3 years and firmly believed all things in life were possible to achieve. Hey, that's a wonderful attitude. You know, if you truly do believe that all things in life are possible to achieve, then you really do have a good, not only do you have a good outlook, but you know that the sky's the limit. You know that if you know that you can pretty much set your mind to anything it is that you want to achieve. New Haven, Connecticut's harbor, by the early 1770s, was a busy seaport located along an uneven coastline between Stamford, I didn't say Stanford like Stanford University, folks, but Stamford, S-T-A-M-F-O-R-D, Stamford and Saybrook, Connecticut. At New Haven's harbor, merchants could be found selling common colonial goods from sugar, pewter, nails, timber, fishing gear to compasses. Well, think about it, folks. You got ships coming in and out of the harbor. So what do you think captains are going to need? I mean, compasses may not last forever, but they might need a new compass for backup in case, say, the compass they have that was working, you know, broke or is no longer able to be repaired, might need to have a backup or two. While New Haven's port, or I should say its harbor, saw immense prosperity, New Haven in general, could not compete with larger cities like Boston and New York, which were each a half-day sail, Boston to the north and New York to the south. Well, we have to remember, folks, you know, if we want to journey somewhere, you know, the vessels that we're using in the 18th century are not motor-powered. So that's going to have to require a lot of muscle. It's going to have to require a lot of manpower and, you know, moving. So that's going to require using oars, and it's going to take, you know, a lot of movement with both hands, with both arms, I should say, in terms of paddling. One person's going to have to paddle on one side, the other on the other. You might have more than two people in the boat, but the bottom line is it's going to be a team effort. I mean, people still do this stuff today, most notably in the sport rowing. If you still prefer to tackle on a challenge, like you could do kayaking, for example. So the 17-year-old fellow and his classmate, being Isaac Gridley, didn't come to shop at New Haven's port. Okay, I'm sure some of you are wondering, well, why are they there then? But rather, they sought to embark upon a half-day sail southward to New York, which would involve, and of course, they didn't know this, folks, and it would be easy to overlook or just not to even think about, but it would involve unpredictable weather. But both men are convinced that the weather was going to stay favorable, where the calm sailing waters would ultimately prevail. Well, I'll tell you, it is always nice to think if you're going to go out for a sail that, you know, the weather's just going to stay sunny the entire time. And, well, you know, I think people often have to learn the hard way that, you know, if you're going to be out on the water for a good part of the day, you might want to bring a little bit of everything with you that there is, because what you may have on clothes-wise right now at the moment might be good for a few hours, but if the weather changes, if you don't have a rain jacket, you know, you might be up a creek, or if you're living on the Great Lakes, as we've learned in the month of November from various podcast segments, various podcast book topic series, I should say, especially the last one that we did, that how people were known to go duck hunting on a mild morning with their shorts on, only for the weather to drastically change in the afternoon and all of a sudden endure paralyzing winter cold weather, to where some people sadly died because they were not, they didn't bring a backup of clothing. They did not modify their circumstances. So things do happen. So the opposite did come about shortly after this trip began, folks. Unpredictable and violent waves came soaring over the sloop's bow, leading 15-year-old Isaac Gridley to look up to his 17-year-old classmate and friend for wisdom. Not long after enduring violent waves did the 17-year-old, whom was considered one of Yale's elite 13 scholars. Wow, I mean, well, we have to probably remember this too, folks, even at this time, that Yale's student population, and probably the same for Harvard and William and Mary, their student population is probably not 1,000. Because after all, folks, very few families could send their sons off to college. It's probably fair to say that maybe 2 to 3% of the population could. And we would have to characterize those people as being upper class, upper middle class, or basically gentry status. So yes, this 15-year-old and Isaac Gridley, he's terrified. Knowing that these waves have, he's probably never endured anything like this before. So he's probably clinging on to dear life and just probably had the wind knocked out of him. But he's obviously looking to his 17-year-old friend for guidance. But his 17-year-old friend says the following, in quotes, "Hang tight for just a moment. The 17-year-old says the following in quotation. "I will never be drowned." That's quite a statement, knowing what just happened. So if somebody asked me, how do you interpret that statement, Kirk? He and his friend might have survived this ordeal, but the next time he's out along the waters in the midst of turbulent weather, there's no guarantee that the outcome will be positive. In other words, who's to say that you might not survive the same being out on the water and you endure waves like what you just endured here? Because, you know, folks, I mean, yes, waves can knock people overboard, but waves can also, if they're powerful enough, they can suck one under. In terms of undertow, where one could drown and might not come back up to the surface. So another primary reason behind why this brashy 17-year-old collegiate student said what he said in regards to the remark of, "I will never be drowned," pertained to a small mark on his own neck. This is getting crazier and crazier, folks. But there is a lot of truth behind this, folks, where we're going. The small mark was none other than a mole, which represented bad luck. I know I shouldn't sound judgmental and be picking on those who have a mole. We shouldn't judge people who have moles on their neck. But perhaps in the 18th century, the times were different. Even worse, well, the small mark, yes, was none other than a mole, which represented bad luck. But even worse, if an individual had hairs growing from a particular mole, it often indicated that death by hanging was imminent, come foreseeable future. Death by hanging? For doing what? Isn't that harsh to say? I mean, isn't that a little unjust in terms of rushing to judgment? On one hand, I think it is. But there again, in the 18th century, there had to be some good, sound, legit reasons for why people are adhering to this belief. Asher Wright, a friend to the 17-year-old since childhood, recalled hearing how other playmates teased him about the mole, only to say that if he wasn't careful, then perhaps one day in the future his fate could be met through getting hanged. Is it fair to say that maybe the 17-year-old as a child was flaunting stuff? Perhaps. You know, oftentimes we think of grown-ups or adults as the ones who tend to flaunt the most, but we do have to be reminded that even young people can get caught up in the moment and flaunt stuff about themselves that is not appropriate, and if it doesn't get corrected, then others will not only maybe not want to be friends with them, but others will say to them, "Hey, look, you know, keep this up and you can expect other consequences down the road if you don't recognize the problems right before you. After the 17-year-old and his classmate brought the boat back ashore in the midst of turbulent weather, he pointed to the mole on his neck and admitted that he would not have drowned. He really thinks he's invincible. He really to me seems as though nothing could happen to him. Wouldn't we all like to think that nothing could happen to us? Well, yeah, but the bottom line is that we should not be thinking that we're invincible. None of us are. You know, we shouldn't live our lives in fear, but we also can't assume that nothing unexpected will happen tomorrow. You know, sometimes we do have to live each day as if it were our last. You know, we're not guaranteed next week. And that's what we have to wonder with this fella. Has someone told him already, hey, look, you're not guaranteed tomorrow. You're not guaranteed 3 weeks from now. You're not even guaranteed a month from now. But if you're not careful, you could endure some unforeseen consequences. And then the question is, if you are stuck between a rock and a hard place, how might you get out of it? Is he pushing people away? I don't think he is pushing people away, but the bottom line is that he could push someone away, and yet he might not even realize it. So, where do we go from here? Isaac Gridley, the 15-year-old classmate, was perplexed by his friend's outlook, given what they just endured along the waters by trying to sail south to New York. Oddly enough, the 17-year-old made a remark that would go with him no matter where his journeys traveled. I am to be hung. Well, now maybe he has come to his senses and realized that, hey, maybe I had allowed myself to be caught up in the moment. And secondly, I had allowed myself to get caught up in the moment so much so that no matter what I take on, the risks are high, and if it doesn't go my way, there is a chance that I might not even come home alive. So in other words, the 17-year-old was carrying bad karma or luck to where danger big and small awaited him no matter what the task was which lied ahead. Yeah, I truly do believe that. I'm not saying this fellow's a bad person, but yeah, he could have been carrying bad karma. In other words, he could be cursed no matter how hard he tries to avoid unforeseen circumstances or circumstances that yes, can get us between a rock and a hard place. The bottom line is that he's got bad karma that is not going away. This 17-year-old collegiate student from Yale College happened to be none other than Nathan Hale, whom a few short years later would enlist in the Continental Army and go about partaking in a mission where life and death itself each were at stake. Well, folks, our story, the title to our next book topic podcast series is the following: Nathan Hale, The Life and Death of America's First Spy by M. William Phelps. I tell you, folks, you know, as I mentioned early on about how when one asked me about going behind the scenes and I mentioned about intelligence, well, when George Washington arrived to Massachusetts, he knew that he was in need of an intelligence network. He knew that if he was going to have to stay, in order to be a step ahead of the British, intelligence needs to be up and about, not sitting around twirling its thumb, doing diddly squat. Intelligence needs to be on the move, sending people out, trying to find out from sources what's going on. Have you seen anybody suspicious coming into your tavern, asking odd questions? Is there someone trying to infiltrate our system? Not only from the British side, but are there people whom we know are patriots? Are they our friends still? But are they doing stuff behind our backs? So in other words, you know, yes, it's one thing to drill the soldiers. It's one thing to impose disciplinary measures. Do all that stuff. It's great. Yes, it's important to be prepared to get ready to go out and face the enemy in battle. But if you want to be a step ahead going into the battle, you need to have intelligence. Without intelligence, you might be up a creek. It depends on the degree as to how bad you might be up a creek. But if you know a few things about the enemy, then at least you're off to the right start. Well, we have covered the prologue to M. William Phelps's Nathan Hale, The Life and Death of America's First Spy. When I'm on the air again next, we are going to learn about The Righteous and Patriotic Man, which means learning a little bit about Nathan Hale's early years of upbringing, also when he first went off to Yale College. We will also learn about the type of classes that he would have taken. We will learn as much of the basic stuff as there is. We might even possibly learn about his family history in terms of connections to a famous incident that occurred prior to the 17th century's end. Well, thank you for your time, as always, and I look forward to being back on the air with you guys. And I will say this, during the time that I was off, I couldn't believe just how many plays I got on a daily basis. I had at least about 1,000 plays over the last 3 weeks, and I want to thank all of you for taking the time to listen to stuff that I have done from years past, especially to those of you who are new to podcasting. And I want to thank those of you living in Colombia. I picked up a new nation. Besides being in the United States, I'm in 77 nations now around the world. So I want to thank those of you in Colombia whom are listening. So it's all wonderful. It just goes to show that all of you do care about history and wanting to learn as much as there is. Yes, we all know that history may not always be pretty, but it is important that we learn about the history so that it doesn't repeat itself again. Thank you again, as always, and I look forward to being back on the air with you all next time. Take care and stay safe.